which we measure our pain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who's currently the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University. He's the first Distinguished Chair of Middle East and Islamic Studies at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has advised General David Petraeus, Ambassador Richard Holbrook, and other U.S. agencies on Islam and foreign policy, and is the author of over a dozen award-winning books, including Discovering Islam, which was the basis of the BBC six-part TV series called Living Islam. His books, among them Journey into Islam, have been translated into many languages, including Chinese and Indonesian, and his latest project, Journey into America, is an unprecedented study based on fieldwork of Muslims in America. His latest book is The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War Against Tribal Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be back.
And it's good to talk to you again, Ambassador. And tell me, what's going on here in terms of, obviously this is a political election year here in the United States, but I was mystified, as you know, the reactions to Republican candidate Mitt Romney have been highly criticized in terms of his criticism of the Obama administration. And since then, of course, Mitt Romney has talked about how there are efforts underway to take God out of his heart and out of the public square in the United States. So as much as we're watching what's going on in the Middle East, there's also here in the United States a kind of strange theocratic debate going on. I'm not aware that anybody is trying in the United States is trying to take God out of anybody's heart or out of the public square. Are you?
No, I don't think anybody is. And I think, again, all these statements, Ian, I've been an observer of the scene for the last decade at least, and relating the scene here in the United States to what's happening in the Muslim world. Everything here is seen through the prism currently of the presidential elections, which means that what Romney says, Obama says, all their supporters say will in fact be based on their calculations of how those statements would affect that particular race, the race for the presidential elections. And therefore, these statements to out religion one another, out American one another, out patriotic one another, to show how enthusiastic and how correct they are, is simply a facet of that particular race. And that, of course, also affects how people look at events unfolding in the Middle East, even the terrible tragedy which took the lives of so many American diplomats in Benghazi, including the ambassador who was such a devoted friend and supporter of Libya. Even that event is being interpreted exactly through this particular prism, which is the present elections, with Romney and his supporters saying Obama has shown weakness, he should have been much stronger, he should have led from the front, and of course Obama's side saying that what he has done is correct and allows America to continue playing a role without getting too involved and bogged down as in Afghanistan.
So, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, what did you make of Hillary Clinton's suggestion that the Arab Spring revolutions have traded the rule of tyrants for the rule of the mob?
Well, Ian, I would analyze it slightly differently. Democracy in the Arab world, and the secretary is talking about the Arab world, and as a result of the what so-called Arab Spring, the Arab world has not really had a tradition of democracy. So you haven't had centuries of democracy in Egypt or Libya or Tunisia or Syria or any of these countries. And therefore, you have a time of dictatorship and then followed by democracy and then a period of adjustment between the two and eventually some form of genuine democracy. You literally are starting from scratch, which means that societies that have been so brutally repressed for decades And this point needs to be driven home. Remember people like Gaddafi in Libya, Saddam in Iraq, Assad and his father in Syria. They've been ruling for literally decades, Mubarak in Egypt, 3-4 decades. Now, suddenly that rule, that authoritarian rule is removed, and ordinary people have no way of expressing themselves except going out into the streets. So there you have the problem of clan rivalry, religious rivalry, sectarian rivalry, and these men of violence who would promote violence for political purposes, Al-Qaeda and so on. So what you're seeing then is a very combustible mix while those governments attempt to create or form some kind of a normal running democracy. And this process is going to take some time. The danger here is a bigger danger, Ian, and that I see as a possibility. I hope I'm wrong, but the possibility that if things don't work out locally, you may have some ambitious young colonel in the Libyan army or air force or in Egypt, some general who may just say enough is enough and bring back the troops and declare martial law. And that whole cycle of military rule will start again and we are back to square one. So these are societies in transition, and tyranny has gone, mob rule for the time being, or aspects of it, mob rule are evident, and what is going to happen next needs to be very firmly put within the framework of all of us encouraging and wanting democracy, however noisy, chaotic, and even costly it is.
Well, Ambassador, ironically, of course, it was an attempt by reactionary forces in Egypt, but specifically Egypt's richest man, who was a crony of Mubarak's, who's a Coptic Christian who owns a television station. He was the one that was disseminating this video of this obscure film that nobody has ever seen. That helped spark this, and presumably his motives were to do exactly what you said, to bring back a kind of to say, look, the Muslim Brotherhood's not capable of ruling; they're an unruly mob, and therefore we need the discipline of the military. I mean, I'm assuming that was his motive.
Exactly, and I think there's right now the situation is confused. The public, the crowds can come out easily, and there's so much anger, and they start burning down things and throwing bricks and stones and things at government buildings. But we all have to step back and understand that there is normally a lot of confusion and lack of information in these events, in any revolutionary situation. And here it is particularly bad. So we are not really sure what exactly is happening, who's doing what to who, and we may only find out after some time. But as you said, you have to use your own intelligence and piece together, connect the dots and say, if this is happening and so-and-so is involved, what would their motivations be? Who would benefit by what they're doing, the actions that they're taking? And you've analyzed it very well yourself, that those people who would like to discredit a government, if they encourage an action which causes so much anarchy and violence and killing and murder and so on, they would obviously benefit because they would hope that some general, some man in uniform would simply say, all right, boys, enough is enough. Load your guns and get into the trucks and let's go and declare martial law. So there's always a danger of that kind of thing happening because of people designing it to happen.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed. He's currently the Chair of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington, D.C., and the first Distinguished Chair of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His latest book is The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War Against Tribal Islam. I think, though, a lot of people here in the United States and in the West are having a hard time, though, understanding how easy it is, if that's the case, to provoke angry mobs through either the Danish cartoons or, in this case, this obscure movie that was so appallingly badly made that nobody in the world would want to see it. And yet, obviously, people are pushing it for their own Machiavellian reasons. But it has to be said that it was financed and promoted to a small degree by a group of religious Christian right bigots here in the United States. So answer that question, if you will, because I am getting a lot of mail on that very issue, is why are Muslims so easily offended?
But Ian, it's a very important question, and you're absolutely right. Americans are extremely concerned about how Muslims are responding. And I know, because I'm part of the debate in the media, I follow it carefully. They do feel that Muslims are oversensitive, and sometimes they feel that Muslims are not particularly rational in their responses, that they're violent, they're too angry, etc., etc. And there's an element of truth there. But there are several things that we need to, again, try to analyze in the situation. First of all, the responses, thankfully, there's no excuse for people being killed under any circumstances, but thankfully the responses have not been of hundreds of thousands of people. Whether it's Libya or Cairo, you're seeing a response which is limited to, I would say, hundreds rather than hundreds of thousands. Secondly, this is not something new. This is a response, I would say, Ian, that is linked to peoples, to nations who are extremely sensitive about certain things that symbolize what they hold dear in their society. So every society is sensitive about those things. Here in the United States, we may be sensitive about the flag, the stars and stripes. We may be sensitive about certain things that we believe symbolize the nation. In India, there would be a different kind of symbolism to represent the nation. In China, in Russia, each nation has something that is valued and they are really moved by, and it moves them to tears, as it were. Now, if those symbols, whether they are men, women, or monuments, or sacred objects, if those are attacked or perceived to be attacked, then people react. They react with unhappiness, with frustration, despair, and anger, and sometimes violence. This is not new, and this has happened. This is human history. Now, Muslims are very sensitive about two things. One is the Quran, the book of the Muslims, and the Prophet, who embodies the Quran for Muslims, the Prophet of Islam. And if you combine them, that really is the basis of faith. So when these are attacked deliberately, one is the routine attack, and Muslims have been facing that for over 1,000 years. But when these are attacked in an attempt to anger Muslims, Muslims very often respond exactly as people expected them to respond, which is with anger. It is, I'm afraid, a rather immature response, because for the last 3 decades, you mentioned the Danish cartoons. You could have mentioned Salman Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses. For the last few decades, people have been provoking Muslims on exactly these issues, and Muslims have responded angrily. And unfortunately, tragically, people's lives have been lost. So you see how a nation or a people's response to symbols it holds very dear. These are the most valued, most precious symbols for Muslims, and it does provoke them. And my feeling here is, Ian, that we really need to be sensitive to each other. We appreciate the importance and absolutely crucial importance of freedom of press, and that must be maintained, freedom of expression that the West achieved after centuries of struggle, and it's incredibly important that we hold on to that concept. At the same time, even in the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, it is accepted that you cannot enter a crowded theater, and start shrieking fire, because that will cause a stampede and people will be injured. And this kind of, you pointed out, the film made by certain people with the express purpose of provoking Muslims, this kind of action obviously is designed to create anger and then violence and then more hatred between communities. And you're upsetting some people and their faith. And I think we need to be much more sensitive than we are in the situation that we have found ourselves.
Well, just in the last minute, obviously the Arab Spring is causing the U.S. Foreign policy, shall we say, challenges. We have largely supported dictators, and we've said we want democracy, but now we haven't even begun to grapple with the enormity of the challenges we face as countries become more politically participatory, and people have a voice. So, and also, just a quick comment on your new book about the global war against tribal Islam. I'm sorry, we've basically only got 30 seconds left.
Ian, we'll have another session.
I think we have to, yeah.
It's really an important book in the sense that I'm analyzing the war on terror through a very different angle, and that angle is tribal Islam, and looking at all these societies that are today involved in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, in West Africa, and these all happen to be tribal societies. So I'm correlating the war on terror with tribal societies and the problems these societies face, the desperation, the economic poverty, and the chaos, the political chaos that is current in these societies. So it is a challenge for them, for those societies, and will continue to be one, and for us in the United States to understand those societies and see how we and they best could move towards a world which would be more peaceful and harmonious than it is at present.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who is currently the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University. He's the first Distinguished Chair of Middle East and Islamic Studies at the United States Naval Academy and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has advised General David Petraeus, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, and other U.S. agencies. He's the author of book, among them Journey into Islam, which has been translated into many languages, and his latest project is Journey into America, and which is an unprecedented study based upon fieldwork of Muslims in America. And his latest book is The Thistle and the Drone: How America's War on Terror Became a Global War Against Tribal Islam. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we're going to discuss the war within Christianity and Catholicism here in this election year.